and welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast by data protection people with me, Ollie Rear. But I'm not on my own for the purposes of this intro. I'm also joined by my good friend, colleague, and master contributor to podcast, Miles Dacres. Hello, Miles.
What an intro.
Yeah, I don't know where that one came from.
Yeah, no, great session today, wasn't it?
Well, that's the thing. I'm all hyped up now. I'm full of energy off the back of that, full of good vibes. Such a good session that I felt I had to give you a particularly strong intro.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, it was actually the first of our healthcare sessions, so it went better than expected, I think.
I think it went absolutely fantastically. And so we can only congratulate our very own Temi for putting together this fantastic event. Some wonderful contributors. We're extremely grateful to them all. They're introduced in greater detail within the session, and we are extremely grateful to them for their time, their insights. It was absolutely fantastic. One of our best sessions of late, I think, Miles.
Yeah, I'd agree, definitely.
Absolutely. So if you are in the healthcare sector yourself, I would really strongly encourage you to get stuck into this podcast. If you've got any other questions relating to the sector in particular, we'll absolutely be looking at doing more sessions in future. So just let us know, come along to those. Even if you're not in the healthcare sector, I would really recommend this. There's some fantastic insights, and it's always good to get some shared knowledge from people in other sectors. So without further ado, there's no point waffling on. I'll let you get stuck into it since it's such a good session. Miles, any thoughts before we get into it?
Not at all, no. I'll just mirror what you've said there and say if you are in the healthcare sector, then we will definitely be doing more of these events in the future and definitely looking forward to them after today's session.
Yeah, absolutely. In the meantime, we'll be back next week with another episode of GDPR Radio, the regular open surgery sessions. So if you enjoy this podcast, then please do try and come along to the live recordings. They're Fridays, every lunchtime. I don't think we actually say that on here, so it's probably worth mentioning it. Half 12 or half one on Fridays. It's a live session. Come along, get involved. You can reach out to any of us for more information about that. But I have done enough waffling. I really want you to get into this podcast because it was such good fun. So without further ado, I will leave you in the extremely capable hands of Barry Malt, Dean Ayres, David Willis, and myself. Plenty on our plate today because we are talking, well, about the healthcare sector generally. The broad theme was supposed to be sharing and controlling access, but as I'm sure you'll see very soon, we've got plenty to talk about outside of that narrow remit. But I'm by no means by myself to talk about this today. I am joined by, as I said previously, three very special guests that I am delighted to have with us. And if I can introduce them, that would be absolutely splendid. I'm just checking because I think one of our guests seems to have frozen, albeit that might just be my screen. But David, I can tell that you're not frozen, so if we could introduce you first. We're joined by David Willis, Acting Senior Information Security Officer. Is that your correct title?
Correct, yes.
Wonderful. Well, welcome, David. We're very pleased to have you. We're also joined by Dean Ayres, Head of InfoSec and Governance, as well as Security. That is Data Security, he's asked me to point out. Good afternoon, Dean.
Hi, thanks. I've turned my camera off because I think the camera's freezing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think I might knock mine off as well, actually, because I'm struggling a little bit. And last but by absolutely no means least, we are also joined by Barry Malt, Data Protection and Privacy Consultant. Good afternoon, Barry.
Good afternoon.
Lovely stuff. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, chaps. We've got plenty to get through, but I'm hoping that as with my usual colleagues, I am able to just sit back and steer the conversation and let you gentlemen lead the conversation. So we're talking broadly about the healthcare sector today. As I say, the theme was sharing and controlling access, but within that we've had some quite interesting questions. And the first one that came up was from you, Dean. And if we could just spend a little bit of time talking about that slightly, because it's quite an interesting one. There's a consequence potentially of not sharing or controlling access properly, which is the concept of disrepute. Do you want to fill us in on what your question was in relation to that?
Yeah, so it was in not really a definition of disrepute, but it really is where the lines are between disrepute and information governance and whistleblowing and a lot of those other subjects that are similar to that. And this comes from the fact that along with a lot of NHS organisations, the information governance team is quite small. The world of information governance is exploding like the Big Bang Theory, and it's starting to include lots and lots of other questions that are coming in, such as, what do you think of this? Or can they post that? Can they do this? And as I was talking with Barry earlier on, it's about public safety. We're talking about public safety here. And we've seen some very, very high profile cases, not necessarily from the NHS in the last couple of weeks, but some very high profile cases where information relating to cases has been shared inappropriately. And I kind of was looking for a dialogue with my colleagues, David and Barry, on their thoughts on that subject.
So we were saying off air, weren't we, that principally we're talking about the impact, aren't we, really?
Yes.
What that looks like practically speaking. And obviously, you know, we've raised it, and we spoke previously when we all got together about this, about realistically the main one is the clinical impact. But I'm by no means the expert here, so I'll happily defer to either you, Barry, or you, David.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting question. And I think for me, that impact that something can have on an NHS organisation, you know, putting it in practical terms, I think, you know, if we do something wrong, you know, the consequences of action from the ICO, either a notification or a fine, doesn't seem to be many of those of recent on health organisations. But having said that, you know, one of the things, if something does go wrong, the ICO will come and it will be the consequence of asking you certain questions about, you know, what have you done to prevent these things from happening. Now, most of the things that get reported to the ICO are probably small things. Doesn't mean to say they're not important, but they're small in comparison. You know, somebody sent an email to the wrong place, and that can have a consequence to the organization. But would something like that bring the hospital into disrepute? Possibly not, because it doesn't hit the headlines. It's, I think what I'm looking at is those things that hit the headlines, the big things that might bring an organisation into disrepute.
Yeah, so effectively we've almost approached the question backwards, really, haven't we? You know, we're talking about sharing and controlling access to information, and we sort of started where we should have finished, really, which is looking at the consequences. Where that, well, no, but you know, this is partly what makes it interesting. We've started effectively where, you know, the consequences crop up. I was really interested when we spoke off air a couple of weeks ago, David, about your point relating to the fact that accuracy a lot of the time is one of the key contributors to broadly, well, incidents, shall we say.
So disrepute, bringing an organisation into disrepute, it's an interesting concept. So at the start of the pandemic, when we had the first rush of vaccines, one of the things that was sort of identified was that people who had a high BMI should be vaccinated. And people with a high BMI were identified within GP records, and GP sent out information saying, you know, you need to go and get yourself vaccinated because you're in an at-risk group, and the at-risk groups are within these age ranges, or, you know, if you're overweight or something. So a journalist that works in Liverpool was kind of surprised that although they were only 30 years old, they'd had a request to go get their vaccine. And it turned out that they had a BMI of 26,000. The reason behind this is because their height, instead of being recorded at 6'2", was recorded as 6.2 centimetres, which would have made them I think they weigh something like 12 or 14 stone. So if you can imagine somebody who's 6.2 centimeters tall that weighs that much, either they're, you know, much more dense than lead, or they're a big, big pancake. The reality is that we do have issues of data quality within our records. There's been many cases of these documented, and it's down to human error. And when these come up, you can put an organization, you know, it doesn't look good for organizations. But the question is, have we actually built out that culture of get it in and get it right? And when we have information that's spread across multiple systems, you know, which is the one that is right? I think going forward, it's going to become more challenging to sort out these questions about accuracy of information. When we're talking about disrepute, it's not just about accuracy. So my biggest bugbear is about availability of information. And I'll pass that back to the people on the panel.
Well, so David, I was just going to say, first of all, I actually have a friend who equally had a BMI almost as high as that, because they were recorded as only being a couple of inches high or a couple of centimeters high. But the other one, because it's interesting, we mentioned that the COVID and the vaccine, was that the NMC have just recently struck off a nurse who promotes is an anti-vaxxer, and the hospital, she's not brought the hospital into disrepute. They haven't brought it against her, but the NMC have said that she's brought nursing into disrepute. And again, I remember that when we were doing the preview of this, and very much with yourself, we were talking about whistleblowers. Now, you know, I think in her case, the mistake was that she's been telling people not to have the vaccine. I think if she'd have said that she didn't agree with the vaccine, that would have been under freedom of expression. What would you think on that one?
So can I come in? I mean, there are a number. There are a number of scenarios we could put in that would indicate, you know, where something's gone wrong, either the recording's wrong, human error, or where maybe the organisation itself has done something wrong. When I came on the call just before everybody else joined, somebody said to me, "How are you, Barry?" I said, "I'm knackered." And the reason being is I was at a Christmas party last night at number 10. No, at the O2. And I got back about 11:15. But what happened yesterday, a rapid review, very rapid, it's taken something like 22 months to publish. And it was about whistleblowing. And it was about somebody raising concerns in a hospital. And in raising the concerns, they wrote to the family and said, "I don't know as the family have told you the full story. I'm just obviously summarizing." And what happened was that letter that was sent, the letter, the envelope, were tested for fingerprints. And also they got the handwriting of the person who wrote the letter, and they compared it with notes that had been done in the hospital. Now, as an IG person, I would say, "Do you know what? Don't even go there." You know, but they did. And the hospital, the reports come out, it's 200 page, took me 2 hours from 11:30 to 1:30 last night, reading all of it. I should have gone to sleep. But, you know, it was rather fascinating because, you know, it's brought that whistleblowing for patient safety. And again, there is some element of IG in there, because there were some things that were not properly disclosed, you know, some just not the full facts were actually given to the person who was doing the investigation. And I think it's things like that that make me nervous about bringing, you know, a hospital, an organisation in disrepute. But if we're talking about our roles as IG people, you know, I think we have to be aware of what the consequences might be, because we might be the people that they come to ask for advice. And bringing it down to practical thing, should they've gone down the road of handwriting and fingerprinting? No, they shouldn't. You know, what can we do to make sure that things, that disrepute doesn't come on our organisations?
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next, you know, segue really, Barry. So thanks for that. Which is that, you know, first of all, you know, where do these issues, we've already touched on it slightly, but where do these issues stem from at source? What's the root cause of a lot of these issues? And then secondly, basically, what do we do to combat them? I offer that to whoever wants to take that. It's a broad question. Feel free to take the first or the second part as you see fit, gentlemen.
Well, I think there's a good one here, which is if we bring Barry's comments earlier on about a well-known performing artist, and the issue is that the access and inappropriate access, if you like, which could lead to disrepute, also can withdraw people's access to healthcare. I mean, if you are a well-known celebrity, you may not want to access healthcare. This is the worst outcome.
Yeah, I think it might be worth me saying that the person was Ed Sheeran. He fell off his quad bike, he damaged his shoulder, and he went into a hospital in Suffolk. And within, you know, I'm going to say minutes of him arriving in A&E, news got around the hospital. You know, why were people telling other people that they got Ed Sheeran in the hospital and people were coming down trying to get the photograph with him? And the same happened with Alex Ferguson in Manchester. He went in, and then what happened? Doctors, consultants were looking up Sir Alex's record. You know, that sort of thing brings the organisation into disrepute, because something has gone wrong. Either the policies are not right, the processes are not right, the training's not right. And I think, you know, they're the big ones, but there are lots and lots of smaller things that happen that just as much worry me. Just because a person's got a celebrity name does not necessarily mean that the other people are not entitled to the same sort of confidentiality and security. They are.
Yep, and this is the sorry to jump in there, but that is the bit that that concerns me the most is that, and I'm sure David would agree that colleagues, the same happens with colleagues. Oh, you know, so and so's in on ward this or been taken into hospital. You know, oh, I wonder if they're all right. Well, so you know, that's the bit.
So I think as we've moved to but let's be kind of honest here. When we had paper records and somebody like Alex Ferguson went in, there'd be a, you know, they'd be showing the paper records around people. The advent of digital means that you don't need to go and find somebody who's got the paper record. The advent of digital means that, you know, if you're logged into the system and have got permissions, you can see pretty much whoever you want to see. Those digital systems perhaps were never designed with that security in mind. So I had a meeting probably about 2 years ago now with a group of guys from New Zealand, clinicians, and all their digital systems have a list of who's accessed the record on the bottom of the screen. There's two reasons behind this. The first is, as you're looking at the record, it might not make sense to you as a clinician. You might need a little bit more sort of narrative. And by looking at that list of people who's interacted, you know who you can talk to. By the same token, anybody that comes along that wants to browse the records will see their name pop up and they'll think, oh, I best not browse these records anymore because everybody can see who's looking at them. And it apparently works really well in the New Zealand system. And going back to Barry's point about Sir Alex, because the Sir Alex case, I was working for the Manchester Hospital at the time, and they had very clear policies, and they had very clear messages that came up on the computer screen that, you know, all this lot will be, and that we monitor the systems. And in spite of people knowing that the systems were monitored, and in spite of the fact that those policies were in place, they still had a double-digit number of people that browse the record.
And I agree with you. And that I've been looking at this subject for a while. And the police are people that are much further down the route of this. The police now, so as an ambulance service, the Police National Computer and our CAD system are very similar. And the when you look at the sort of Computer Misuse Act, the number of police officers that have been prosecuted for inappropriate illegal access to that is far greater. So I suppose my other question back to us as a group is that coming? Is that expectation that we monitor to that level coming, or is it already here?
There's a question just gone into the chat from Emma.
By all means, Barry, because I was going to pick up on that. So
yeah, please. Hi Emma. I think, you know, we've talked about consequences. So David, I like that system. Quite straight away you can see who's accessed the record, you know, whether another clinician. So yeah, but I can give an example where somebody in the hospital I was working in worked in maternity. And therefore, it would give you an indication of what records she should be looking at. But because she had access to, you know, lots more records, she went and looked up 29 men's records. And then that's inappropriate access. But then the inappropriate disclosure, she went to the local pub and started doing this, you know, and talking. It was overheard and somebody reported it. So me gave her the benefit of the doubt and said, why? They might have been partners, husbands, and there might have been some reason, no reason whatsoever. She was suspended, we investigated, and she was eventually dismissed. But she was reported to the ICO, and the consequences, Emma, was that she actually went to court and she got fined. So she lost her job. The fine actually was about £600-700. It was nothing. And, you know, so there are consequences. And somebody said to me when I complained about the fine being so small, and I said it should have been at least £5,000. And they said, yeah, but Barry, she's lost her job. She'll not get a job again quickly. I know that 2 weeks later, she was working in a local department store in the town where she'd just been fired from the hospital. So there are some consequences. You know, and we don't want people to not be able to get a job. They still need to be able to live and pay bills and what have you. I'm not that cruel, but there needs to be consequences to those.
I agree with you, Barry. And I think so. I think somebody just mentioned, you know, that the police will sack policemen who inappropriately access the records. And rather bizarrely, once again, a conversation from about 2 or 3 years ago, as I was driving through the tunnel under the Mersey, I was discussing with a police officer exactly that, you know, how the police discipline their staff when they inappropriately access records. And one of the things that sort of jumps to mind is that there was another hospital in the Northwest where an entire department got into a cultural thing of browsing the records. It was a specialist department, so there were only about 8 or 10 people, but they were specialist clinicians. And they got into a little thing where, you know, they go and browse some records and they chat about it in their break time and so on and so forth. And some of that information sneaked out and suddenly it ended up in the public purview. And the next thing, the hospital is facing an ICO investigation. I still don't know the outcome of that investigation, but people started suing the hospital, but the hospital was in a difficult position of how do you sack all these staff, because it's an entire department we're looking at. And these are specialist clinicians. What do you do? We can't get specialist clinicians into these roles. We really struggle. So rock and a hard place. How do we drive that message that... And don't get me wrong, we all do it. We drive the message around confidentiality. And we by doing that, we can actually have... And in the case of that department, I don't think there's any excuses. None at all. But by the same token, we get people who are so scared about the potential for this happening that they don't share information. That's a bigger problem.
No, I agree with David very much. So, and also, David, it's Dean, and I totally agree with that all those names at the bottom of the record. I think that's a superb idea. But the taking it down a similar vein, and I've seen a message come up about social media, and we talk about sort of the implications of your actions. So two police officers this in the last week or so have been imprisoned for 2 years for taking or distributing inappropriate photographs from the murder scene. So, you know, if we go to that, you know, but interestingly, down a different set of a different line of criminality rather than through the ICO. So it there are sanctions out there, but I'm with you, David. I mean, how do you get when it's a whole team, you know, of specialist sort of head injury specialists? What do you do? Because you can't get rid of them all. It just doesn't work. Barry's waiting.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And if we go back to that disrepute as we started with, so when something big like that happens, you know, do you sack all those people? And the thing I always thought of, and sometimes, say an A&E department, you know, does something like that, you know, and staff go and look at, or let's go back to the Ed Sheeran. So who in A&E started to tell people that Ed Sheeran was in their text messages, WhatsApp and all that sort of stuff. Then, and it hits the news. Do people stop going to A&E in Ipswich? The answer is no, they won't, because that's their local hospital. That's their local A&E. And if they've had an accident, that's where they're going to go. So, you know, in some ways, I understand the disrepute bit, but I've always had this thing in my mind that when something like this has happened, people will still go to some places because they don't have any other choice. Now, we do have a choice, but if it's their local hospital, you're not going to go and travel 25 miles to an A&E when it's just 3 miles down the road. It's a little bit of an interesting dilemma.
It is, Barry, and that's where this is where I'm going to provide my specialism, which is in the ambulance service. In that, actually, there isn't a choice, because if you're in Ipswich and you dial 999, you can't get one from West Midlands or from Lancashire or London Ambulance Service. They won't supply you an ambulance. The only ambulance you're going to get is from East of England, and quite rightly, they're going to take you to Ipswich Hospital because that's the nearest A&E. So the friends and family. Family test, the disrepute, what there isn't a choice, but it's that inner feeling, isn't there, for the individual, for the patient that's being treated. I want them to believe that they are getting the best possible care, and they will be from my organisation, and they will be from Ipswich Hospital. But if their feeling is that it will be less because of the actions of a few, and I mean a few people, that's still a tremendous impact. And as somebody that's worked with you know, with elderly people, they can be very affected by just a few words, and particularly when that's in the media. And suddenly everybody gets tarred with the same brush. We're so familiar with that, aren't we? So I do worry about how people feel when they're being taken to that A&E department from that disrepute. They don't have a choice, but does it make them feel worse?
Yeah, 100%, Dean. I just wanted to pick up on a couple of points because the chat has really sort of livened up on these points, and I certainly don't want to make people feel like they're not being heard. Lawrence has put a few interesting points in the chat, the latest of which relates to the potential for people suing under misuse of private information, which is... yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess it's ultimately the issue, isn't it, is that if you're ultimately relying on the data subjects, the individuals, to bring about, let's call it enforcement by themselves, you've already lost effectively from that perspective, I'd have thought. I don't know if any of you chaps any thoughts on that, or if Lawrence, you want to come on and talk about it, please do feel free to do so.
Yeah, I was just going to say really quickly on that, because I have to go off to another meeting. I do apologize. Is that it's not that the individual necessarily holds them to account directly. It's that if you have an organization that gets an ICO notice, that is a red flag to any solicitor to say, okay, is my client affected? So if I see a notice, the ICO will say, okay, we're not going to fine you, but we did find against you, right? Well, right there, that's the ICO confirming there's been some sort of data breach or data issue, which then puts the blood in the water. So the sharks, no offense to lawyers, but it's the analogy. it's at the watering hole. There's a wounded animal. Now all the predators come. And so somebody will go, well, wait a second, what about me? Did that affect me? I put in a SAR. Where's my personal data? Suddenly that organization will find itself under the weight of the individual's accountabilities. Now, does that work perfectly? It's not, let's say, 1,000 piranhas, but it starts that process where we start to have class action suits or people saying, well, what about me? What about me? So, yes, that individual, those bunch of GPs or those specialists might think that they're invulnerable or that won't really affect them. You can't sack us all. Sure. But the organization can feel a lot of pressure. And if I was the organization, I'd say, okay, we're going to put a letter of management advice in every single one of your things. So when you go out for your next job, you're going to have to explain that. And you'll be part of that crew that was, yeah, you were part of that group that was reading people's files. And then you have to explain that the next time you go. Wait, where were you working last? It's like using the American example really quickly. I used to work for the Trump administration. Oh, did you now? You know, it's like that. You know, no one worked for the Trump administration. I wasn't there. You know, I was in prison at that time. That's where my 4 years were, you know, because I don't want to admit that, because who's going to hire me? Yes, sure, I can get a job somewhere eventually, but you also have to be able to walk down the street, and then your family, your friends. It there's a psychological pressure to this, so I wouldn't underestimate that. But that's moving quickly. Sorry.
Yeah, good point.
No, thank you, Lawrence. Yeah, excellent point. I guess following on from that, there's another comment that I wanted to pick up on, and I'm sorry I haven't got a name because it's just signed in as governance. But an interesting point, and I guess this is what I want to come on to, which is how do we combat all of this ultimately? But this initial point from the person on the session asking, you know, we can sort of, as professionals, you know, we can be blue in the face explaining the rules to everyone, saying, well, this is what you have to do. But ultimately, unless we're able to communicate the actual impact, the actual harm on people, a lot of the time that remains a conceptual risk, I feel. How do we actually manage to translate that practically speaking? We've already talked about those clinical outcomes possibly, but from a training perspective, from a communication perspective, how do we get that across properly?
So there's a culture thing here. So I'm looking at disrepute. So let's look at disrepute in its widest term, and let's pick out possibly the worst disrepute we can think of, which would be East Staffs. So East Staffordshire, for those who have any memory, was the hospital where patients were forced to drink water from vases because the nurses couldn't do their job because they were so significantly understaffed. The outcomes of this were sort of a formal public inquiry. You know, people had died needlessly because they weren't being staffed properly. The hospital in question was completely focused on being a foundation trust and mm-hmm. had forgotten about basic care standards. Nurses were struck off. The entire management team ended up getting replaced. I'm presuming that East Staffordshire Hospital still exists. And it's still running as an organisation. And if you call for an ambulance and get taken to East Staffs, you know, it's under a different management. It's possibly doing a lot better. Now, that was basic patient care. Perhaps the thing that isn't quite as high on the agenda of people within large acute trusts or even smaller organisations is the importance of information in running their business. And it doesn't matter whether that information is operational statistics or basic patient data. If it's basic patient data and you lose it, and it's a bad loss, perhaps it's a large scale loss, you're in a Staffordshire hospital situation and you may never have thought about that loss before. If it's a member of your staff that goes and blurts out some stuff and brings you into disrepute, it might not close your organisation down, but it could well mean monitor coming in and replacing the management structure. There's blame to be held against all who are complicit in the inappropriate use of information, but actually giving us a culture that says, well, actually, your organisation is dependent on information in order to do its job. I don't think we're that clear cut within our organisations yet.
It's interesting, Davey, you mentioned, because I think we have to think, we always seem to think, well, do we not always think, but lots of people think it is just about, you know, information, inappropriate access and people talking or sending emails to the wrong place. But that's a really interesting one about data not being available, because data not being available, you know, I was a nurse as well, and therefore knowing if the information isn't available, it does put the patient at risk. And when I do training, and training is a good way of making sure that people are aware of their roles, the responsibilities to keep data safe and secure. I worked in a hospital where the bedpan macerator above health records, and it was a C. diff ward, and all this brown gooey stuff came flowing through the ceiling onto the patient records. They're contaminated with C. diff. There's nothing you can do about it. We lost, I can't remember how many, hundreds of records. It was reportable to the ICO. It was an accident. I don't think we could have ever thought that bedpan macerator is going. But once it happened, there were actions and lessons we had to learn to make sure that that didn't happen again. Or it was, you know, we reduced the risk. And so I think you're absolutely right, because those records not being available has an impact on the care that we deliver or can't deliver because we don't have some of the information.
I also think that there's a little comment there that I would put is that I think you're right, Barry, that that once they realise that action, they took actions. But I wonder how many other hospital trusts had macerators above records, because it wasn't, the learning wasn't shared across.
So, and that's what the thing is, as soon as you have something embarrassing happen to your organisation, the first thing you do is shut the door so it doesn't go out. That's shared learning. Really needs to be out there.
So, Dean, can I ask you a question? Because the ambulance service, you know, as a very bespoke service that you provide, and I know because I've had these conversations with people from the ambulance service trying to get information to be able to treat patients, again, is a big risk for the ambulance service, because people will not share with the ambulance service.
Very, very, very much so. It is a constant struggle, and has been for probably the last 10 years. I can think back to the early days of the MINAP study, which is the myocardial infarction national audit. At the time, it was project, not program, because it was when it started, it was, the P was for project. Indeed, we wouldn't even be given the outcomes of the patients that we treated and taken into different hospitals. It is changing, but it is very, very slow. One of the main reasons for this is, and this is just one of those things that goes to do with that inappropriate access, that when we talk about most other areas within healthcare, they have lists or known lists or PAS systems, patient administration system. The East of England Ambulance Service, for instance, our population base is 6 million people. And we don't have a list of them all. Everybody's potentially a patient of ours. We have two international airports, we've got roads, we've got several ports, we've got transient people coming through, and they're all our patients. So, you know, I think if you can remember that phrase, you know, from Blackpool to Brighton, if you have an accident, you'll be able to access somebody's record and get them. I think that was somewhere in the early thousands. That was a buzz word from somebody or other in government. We're still not there. If we get somebody who's coming down from Blackpool and they're involved in an accident in on the A1 or the M1, we might not know anything about them. So yes, you're completely right.
But that there's two things with that. One is the access to the data, or not having the access to data, is a patient risk issue. Absolutely. But also for IG people here, you know, we have to work with different organisations to make sure. And the fact we're moving down the route of integrated care systems and ISBs, and David is the technical one. And it's interesting, David, because you talked about those names at the bottom of that when we have the integrated care systems and we are joining all sort of computers up together, is that likely to happen? Names at the bottom of who's accessed those records?
I think David dropped out for a second.
So sorry, my team's crashed again. It seems to be, I think it's in the middle of doing an update and it's just having a complete barney. At the moment, I don't see an appetite for that happening, but it is something that I'm pushing for. So I'm working for what's called an integrated community service. So we're looking to sit above primary care, secondary care, and adult social care. And we'll be providing digital systems that integrate across there. So you'll have a single viewer with appropriate role-based access, so that if you are an adult social care person, you will be able to see the bits of the record that you need to see. And if I can keep the voice going in saying we need that list at the bottom, yeah, maybe it will change things. I don't know.
Well, I like this at the bottom, and I agree with that. I just wonder, Barry and Dave, because we do live in the same big house, if you like, of the NHS, that how many of our colleagues that are listening to this don't realise that how little sharing there is? How many of the public think that these records are actually already shared? And I hear quite surprised that you don't know that?
I went with the CCG, it was a few years ago now, into Bury St Edmunds, and we asked people in the street, in the town, you know, about the sharing of their records. And actually 90% of people said, we thought you already did. And exactly, there was 10% that said, don't you dare, without asking me. No, we've moved on since then, where GDPR came in. We don't need consent for direct care. But it's interesting, you know, we are still fighting some of those battles with some of our colleagues, IG colleagues, and some of our clinical colleagues about sharing data. I think we do need to move forward. And one of the things I'm really keen for sharing data, but it has to be done safely and securely. And I remember Mr. Hancock, when he first came in, everybody will know he's great on technology. David must have loved him because he wanted all this new technology. And I kept pointing on this on the Twitter, so long as it's safe and secure. And then he put something on the week after, and I said, so long as it's safe and secure. 3 months later, somebody said, Matt Hancock said, we're going to have this new IT system. We're going to make sure it's safe and secure. I thought, yes, he's listening. Don't think so.
Well, I tell you what, this is what I sort of wanted to come on to, I suppose, because we've got about 20 minutes left. I'm conscious of time. We spent a lot of time talking about potentially failings and the negative consequences associated with all that. I would like to be potentially slightly more upbeat, if we can, at least in the latter part of this session, which maybe proves that we were right to do it the wrong way around. You know, we can actually end on a positive note, which is looking at things that you'd all like to see in terms of whether it's a specific control or measure, or maybe more from a cultural point of view, something a bit broader. And also potentially I'd like to hear any experiences that you've got with some real success stories in terms of measures that you've implemented, whether it's a particular type of training, a particular type of communication that's gone out, anything like that. That, you know, just so we can, as we were saying, share some knowledge and make sure we all improve from that perspective. Long as no one says I haven't got any success stories, which
well, the answer is I certainly have success stories, and I think the one of the success stories that I have the most trouble explaining to people within the organisation that is a success is the increase in the incident reporting of data incidents, because it's this kind of misnomer, you know. Oh, Dean, since you've come in, things have got a lot worse. We've had all these extra incidents been reported, and it's trying to explain to people that no, there's no more happening than there was a year ago. It's just that you know about them now, and a bit like Barry's macerator above the records, because we know about them, we can start to fix them, because mm-hmm. we know these things are going on. So, you know, for me, the biggest success with the team that's been put in, because 2 years ago the team was kind of one person, and now it is a team, is this it is education. It's about getting people aware, and that awareness then is encouraging people to say, oh, this happened, that wasn't available. That's a common one with us, where something wasn't available. We've got a, you know, 700 odd vehicles out there that they do have electronic communications, but it's mobile data, so sometimes it's not available. And you know, all those incidents that come through help you to build better systems. So for me, that's a real positive and big success, and somewhere that I can plan and work from.
Good. Are you going, David, or shall I?
So I'll let you go, Barry. So I've said quite a lot. I mean, I'm looking at screens here. Following up from your comments, you know, some research out of Greater Manchester, 63% of people believe their GP surgery would use their information appropriately. 61% thought that their records were already shared with hospital doctors.
Yeah.
That's about a year ago.
Yeah. So when it comes to the positives, I've got, you know, loads of positives. I hope I'm a positive person, although I do see some of the negatives at time, of course. And one of them was, I think that the positive is getting the senior people, the board, on side. Now, we all know we have to do IG training each year. And if you're in the NHS, 95%, well, you know, tick the box. But it's getting those different groups, whether it be consultants, nurses, housekeepers, but the board, the senior people involved. And I was asked to go and speak to a large trust board. Now, I live in Suffolk, and I was asked to travel 3 hours to go and speak to a board. And I said, how long have I got? They said, half an hour. I said, you want me to travel 3 hours there, 3 hours back to talk to the board for half an hour? And they said, yeah. And they said, Barry, we just want you to come and tell them about their accountability, so that they you know, they realize their accountability to protecting people's data. And so I went, and to me, the success was 2 days later, I got an email from the chief exec saying, thank you ever so much. We've got a number of actions to carry out. And, you know, I thought that was absolutely great. And I think, again, it starts what we call it. It's those communications. And sometimes we all know data protection, privacy is boring. You know, you say that to people and then their eyes roll. But we have to be better at communicating in different ways of what it is that we're trying to get over to them.
So I guess that ties into to an extent to what Linda's asking in the chat, which is, what is the key aspect of changing culture to support a positive and safe reporting culture, back to what Dean was saying. But I suppose that has got to be an absolutely key contributor, right? A communication. And not necessarily training, because, you know, we often think, and I know all the IG professionals on here will know about this, you know, death by PowerPoint type of training. But ultimately, clear, effective, efficient communication really is number one, right?
It's all about making information available and understandable. So I think one of the success things that's beginning to happen, I think most trust boards now have access to something called Modern Hospital. It's a set of statistics that sits on an NHS national website that shows their hospital, shows their patient flow, shows the number of people that are going in, the number of people that are being discharged. As of the beginning of this week, it's gone live with where you are with your DSPT, you know, what you're like with your cybersecurity. There is hope to put other things in there. So that we can actually start saying, you know, this is what your hospital looks like from an information perspective, from the safety of your patients, from the information that you hold. It's not advanced enough to start pulling stuff out of your incident logs yet. But I mean, I tried, 3 years ago to try and show to the board of the hospital I was working through at the time, you know, what information looked like. And only about 10% of our incidents were based around confidentiality. And there was a chance that there might have been some harm, but there was never actual harm. But when you looked at accuracy, which was about 50% of our incidents, and availability, which was about 40%, there was actual real patient harm, and there was actual financial cost to fixing the problems that had been caused by inappropriate information use.
It is. It's all things, David, isn't it? It's not just one thing, and we could all give different examples. You ask, I always say, you ask 10 IG people for an opinion on how to do something, you'll get 20 different answers. I just want to, a bit of a challenge, really, because if we are going to communicate in a different way, all the aspects, whether it's availability or whether it's inappropriate access and all those sort of things, we have to do it in a way that's engaging. The end of January, Data Protection Day, don't tell me it falls on a Saturday or Sunday. If it does, I've just shot myself in the foot. So the 28th of January, it's a Friday, Data Protection Day. And I just want to say a challenge to people. Why not think about making that day in your heart, leading up to it, not just that day, and of saying, look, on the Friday, and how are you going to communicate some of these issues in a positive way to make people sit up and understand?
But if we're going to be talking about protecting data, let's make sure it's not just about keeping it confidential. Yeah,
no,
it's about making it available. It's about keeping it accurate. And there's so many positive statements that can be found from, you know, this is the life-changing thing that happened to somebody because their data was shared appropriately with another organization.
This is, I mean, as Barry alluded to earlier on, one of the big challenges as an ambulance person I've had is this appropriate sharing of data with us, and the Caldecott guidelines have over the years been thrust towards me as reasons why I can't have a particular thing, and yet the entire report was the sharing of data. It's a shame that such a fine report, such a well-written report, should be used against another set of individuals. Now, the problem we suffer with as an NHS organisation is that we're paramedics as a profession. That's a very, very young profession in terms of the medical profession. But it's interesting. I just noticed that there's a question gone in that says, we've talked about how we control our own data, but what about where we don't have control over the other communication systems, such as social media? So this goes back to that case that I was talking about earlier on, with police officers. Any thoughts on that one?
Well, that's exactly right, Dean, because I mean, I think part of the issue comes back to something that Dave was saying previously, with the rise particularly of digital media, increasingly the barriers to inappropriate access and sharing have been eroded, particularly in the context of that social media question, because whereas previously maybe if you accessed some patient information that you then wanted to go and disclose to anybody that would hear it, if you didn't have a direct line of communication, well, how are you going to get that out there? Now it's a couple of clicks and all of a sudden it can be over the internet. Exactly. Yeah. So there has been erosion there, but you know, how do we combat that? I don't necessarily have an answer. I don't know if either of you have any thoughts.
For me, the only real way is what, as Barry has already sort of said and alluded to, is about communication. It's about people understanding where they sit and their roles and responsibilities.
I would say it's more to do with culture. So we I'm not the world's biggest fan of our current Prime Minister, but he did actually say something useful at the event that he held the other day, which was, you know, are we going to make COVID vaccinations mandatory? Well, before we make them mandatory, we need to have a discussion with society about what's the impact on you. Yeah, and we need to have that same conversation with society around information. You know, you're thinking of posting this stuff on social media. How would you feel if somebody else had that information about you and posted it on social media?
I'm dealing with an issue at the moment where a telephone recording, somebody rang an organisation, both the patient were rude and the staff were rude. They put in a subject access request, they got a copy of that recording and they put it on YouTube. You know, we can't stop some of that happening. They can record us, they can request it, but we can't go and put stuff like that on and saying, look, this is how rude he was, and we can't go and put it on YouTube. But they can. But it does come down to culture, David. We have to know how to act professionally in all the things that we do, in the way that we speak, the things that we record. You know, I was on another webinar earlier on this week, and we were talking about what people used to record in the past, and it was to do with the accelerated access to patient records. You know, people now need to be careful what they write, because that's going to go into the patient record that will be available through the NHS app. And so, you know, we need to be careful about what we write. So that makes data hopefully will increase, you know, good data quality. And then the availability, the patients have it as well, to be able to, if they decide, sorry, Dean, if they decided to go from Suffolk to Hertfordshire or wherever it was. Well, you still cover that part.
Yes, we still cover that part.
But if they wanted to go somewhere else, they will have their record to be able to take with them. So I think there are some positives out there. But it's, again, it's one of those things that there's lots of training that needs to be done, and lots of assurance. We need to give people assurance and reassurance that what we're doing is in the patient's best interest.
I agree, and I agree with David as well. It's cultural change. My communication answer was really about communication, about changing culture as a way forward, because until we do that, I think the problem sometimes with social media is that rapid, the speed of it. So a bit like, as you were saying, Barry, with Ed Sheeran, they've seen him, they text it to their colleague, but the brain hasn't actually been engaged, particularly between the visual and the finger.
Yeah.
So I think one thing to be clear of, the NHS has been delivering care since 1947, 48. And when a GP broke down in his Lloyd George folder, his record of the patient, that was his record. There was never, ever any designed intent to share that with anybody else, other than maybe a locum when the doctor went on holiday, or maybe the doctor's replacement when he retired. And that was the limit of sharing. So a lot of stuff went into that record. That mindset may not really have changed, because we still run a system whereby we do referrals. So the doctor looks at their record, they type up something with some information on it, and they pass it on to the next organisation. They chuck the patient over the fence. Now, we've been on a digital journey for the past 20 years where we've tried to say, here's a shared patient record. But I'm not sure we've managed to change that mindset of, this is my record, just yet.
It's interesting. I suppose maybe the segue is a bit too loose on this one, but I see a link to what Daniel's saying in the chat, which is in terms of combating what you were saying before, Barry, in terms of things being recorded, you know, phone calls, etc. Daniel's saying that they make it really clear to all colleagues that anything they put in customer notes, Teams chats, emails can end up being released in a subject access request. And, you know, I still go into private sector organizations now, and you announce that to people and they still look at you with shock and horror, and they go, what do you mean everything can be disclosed in three? You say, yeah, of course it can. And there's still an issue there around, that's what Peter's saying, applicable in all sectors. There's still an issue around, you know, that understanding. So I suppose, again, it comes back to what we were saying about communication. We're almost out of time, and even though I'd happily sit here all afternoon, I'm sure not everyone is able to do so. So we've got a couple of minutes. We've covered quite a lot today, whether that was necessarily on brief or not. Personally, I don't mind, because I think it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you all this afternoon. However, any closing thoughts from our panel at all on this subject, or even anything else, quite frankly? Barry, if I could come to you first for any closing thoughts.
Yeah, I'm just going to go on that last point that we're talking about people being careful what they're writing records. I once went to a doctor and said, we've had a subject access request. You've wrote this in the record. He said, don't disclose it. I said, no, I'm going to have to disclose it. It'll be your job to sit before the patient and tell him why you wrote that. Solitary sort of lesson for him.
Absolutely. Dean, any closing thoughts from you?
I've had a wonderful afternoon. I have been speaking with one of my favourite people, Barry, and my new favourite person, David, because I've not really met David before, but I've met Barry a few times. And it has felt like a fireside chat, and that has been really, really good. And it's been everything I wanted to. Equally, to carry on with Barry's there, I went to a coroner's court some 10 years ago, and they read out the gentleman's notes from 1972, which says which the doctor had written, this patient does not care about his health, and neither do I.
And on that jolly note, David, any closing thoughts?
You're on mute,
David.
Oh, we've done so well.
I've got off mute. So one closing thought. So I don't know how many of you are aware of a GP called Dr. Amir Anand. He runs a GP practice in Hyde. And he took over from Dr. Shipman, who was actively killing his patients. And to rebuild patient confidence, what Dr. Anand did is he immediately started giving as much access to the patient record for the patient as possible. But then he noticed something really weird, which was a demographic, generally of males between about 50 and 70, who had no digital technical capability whatsoever, but were regularly going into their records. And he couldn't understand this until he started questioning them. And no, they weren't going into their record. Their wife or partner was, because then they were saying, look, the doctor's told you to cut back on salt. The doctor's told you not to drink so much. The doctor's told you to give up fags. And we've got to realize is that once the record is in with the patient, the patient will share it as they think appropriate as well. And if what's in that record shows that that patient's been doing something potentially inappropriate with another man or another woman, that's going to have impact as well. We really do need to design our information systems and make people aware of what's going to happen when we start sharing information. Yeah. I think there's huge positives going forward, and I've really enjoyed myself this afternoon, aside from Teams being a pain in the bum.
Excellent. Well, I think we can all agree on that last sentiment, both in regards of having a wonderful time and of Teams being potentially a pain in the neck. On that note, before Teams kicks me out for that slander, thank you ever so much, gentlemen, for your time, for your efforts. A really, really fantastic session. Very much enjoyed it. The fireside chat, as Dean says, is what we aim for, and I think we've done that fantastically. Extremely grateful to you all for your time. Also extremely grateful to all those on the session today in attendance. Some really fantastic contributions. We hope you enjoyed that. These are regular sessions for those of you who are not regular attendees. We will be back next week with a broader GDPR-based open surgery, GDPR radio, we call them. So if you've enjoyed this, then please do come along. It's very much the same tone, albeit that will be on a broader set of topics. So on that note, I shall leave you all for this week. Thank you again so much to Barry, Dean, and David for your time. Thank you all for attending, and I hope you have a good day.